Good afternoon. First of all, let me express my appreciation to Jeff for covering for me for this class when I couldn't be here. I really appreciate that. Of course, my own feelings are very conflicted at this point. I hate to miss a class. It's the first class that I have missed in 24 years of teaching here at Fuller. So not that I'm trying to establish a record, it's just that that's where I get my gratification from teaching. So I thought I would take this opportunity to share with you some of my thoughts on the concept of the call. This is on pages 31 and following, Unit 9 of our expanded lecture syllabus. My thoughts here are pretty existential, autobiographical, and I want to enlarge upon some of the material you find in the notes there. First of all, that concept of a call is a very traditional one in Christian circles. Primarily, it has related to the concept of a church calling a pastor. They have calling committees and the processing of a call. One is often thought of as being called into the ministry, and that usually means pastoral ministry, or calling to be a missionary. And that this is meant to be some type of subjective experience where one receives a direct word from God, that this is confirmation that the call has been attached to a particular vocation. I remember when I left the pastor of a church and went to study at Edinburgh in Scotland and then went into the teaching ministry, I was asked why I decided to leave the ministry and didn't I have a calling to be a pastor. What about that? So many of us, I think, have grown up with the idea that to talk about a calling is primarily related to the pastor in the church and maybe a missionary. Full-time Christian work, in other words. My thought here is to, first of all, to do some theological reflection on that concept and then to enlarge a bit upon how in our own personal life we are to understand how God is leading and perhaps calling us. You'll notice the quotation there on page 31. That's from a contribution to the Department of the Laity in the World Council of Churches back in 1963. And it says, through his baptism, Christ was initiated into the ministry which led him to the cross and resurrection. Thus, the baptism of Jesus was consecration to his vocation, that is, his calling as the Messiah. Similarly, through our baptism, Christ incorporates us and ordains us for participation in his ministry. According to this understanding of baptism, to be baptized means immediately to be called to the life of a servant. Now, that article goes on to express the fact that what is meant by ordination should really be attached to the fact that one is baptized into the ministry of Christ, and that that's what primarily ordination is. The secondary sense of ordination is that a local church or a local ministry or some other or Christian organization will call a person to a particular task and set that person apart for the ministry. So I was ordained by the Evangelical Free Church of America, served as a pastor there for 11 years. But in this sense, you see, my ordination to the role of being a pastor by a local church is really premised upon the fact that I was baptized into Christ and into Christ's ministry. For example, if I should somehow renounce my baptism, my ordination would be nullified because my baptism is what grounds me and my life in the ministry of Christ. Therefore, every person and every Christian baptized by whatever means and by whatever time, baptized into Christ, is ordained and called to Christ's ministry. Now, the ministry of Christ then, you see, was not determined by a particular task, and it's instructive that there's nothing in the scripture that speaks of the ministry of Christ prior to his baptism. Here's at about the age of 30, he is set apart by the Holy Spirit at his baptism to become the Messiah. Therefore, whatever he does from that point on is the fact he is ordained or called or set apart into the ministry of serving God the Father. I've often said that the world did not set the agenda for the ministry of Jesus. Jesus does not serve the world on behalf of the Father. Jesus serves the Father on behalf of the world. His first calling is to be obedient and to serve the Father. And then the Father sends him to whatever task or whatever place he should go. So that, for example, with Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, when Lazarus is sick unto death, Mary and Martha send to him and said, Lord, he whom thou lovest is sick unto death. And you have the power to heal him, which he did. But Jesus did not go immediately. They assumed that the desperate need of Lazarus and the love of Jesus for Lazarus constituted a priority and a demand. Not so. Jesus only went when he was sent. His first ministry is not simply to serve the needs of people, but to serve his Father. And then his Father sends him. When he goes to Lazarus and finds he's already dead, he then goes not simply because he is drawn there by his love for Lazarus, but he is drawn there and is there under the power of God. And when he raises Lazarus from the dead, he said, now you will see the glory of God. So that in one sense, I want to disarm the concept of a call as relating primarily to a Christian vocation. To identify a calling with a task and vocation, I think, is theologically incorrect. And I think it can be very dangerous, because the task, even of ministry, the vocation, whatever it is of ministry, has no concept of a Sabbath in it. My ministry at the church for 11 years, the church never constituted my relationship there as having some built-in Sabbath concept, some place of rest. The insatiable needs of the people never take into consideration that the pastor, counselor, minister needs some Sabbath, some rest. Whereas for Jesus, he felt free, perfect freedom, to leave people unhealed, to leave aside the preaching of the kingdom of God, and to take off by himself and to be with the Father, with his disciples, to experience that kind of Sabbath rest. So I want to say that every Christian is, in a sense, then called into the ministry of Jesus Christ, and that whatever vocation one takes up is fulfilling of that calling. Now then I talk about the sense of a call, how I try to understand my own personal life of orientation. Am I doing the will of God? Am I called to be a teacher now? And how do I sense that? I argue, as I state here, that one's life as a calling of God has to do with a certain congruence between self-identity and self-destiny. So that the call is not attached to a particular task, rather to Christ, one's service of Christ. I've told this story before, perhaps in this class, can't remember now, but when I was a small boy taking lunch out to my father in the field on the farm, he was plowing with horses, and as we sat there in the furrow and he ate his lunch, he suddenly had me stick my hand down into the soil and said, son, stick your hand into this soil. This soil is your life. You take care of it and it'll take care of you. Now, I did remember the words, but had no sense of what it meant until later on in my life. I became a teenager and later on began to have an incredible, strong sense of being attached to the soil. After service in the U.S. Air Force, the Second World War, returned to the farm, and there sought to find a way which I could enter into that relationship that my father had with the soil. After graduating from agricultural college, I rented a farm and really felt that this was the place I should be. My father died in October of that year, and I had started farming in March. And one summer he was out, and I was milking one of my two cows, and he said, son, it seems now you have really found your place and what you really are to do with your life. And for him, that was a certain sense of satisfaction that his son, I guess, had found a way to continue on in that particular family type of vocation. And I agreed to that. Yes, good. I felt the same way. But within a few years, as my wife and I made a commitment to Jesus Christ and became active in church ministry and in teaching, I began to feel a certain dissonance with that. I began to feel an incredibly strong urge upon me to leave. But the going to Fuller Seminary then became the outworking of that, with a certain sense of tension in my life. I felt that my love for the soil, my relationship to my father and the soil was there, but the call of God upon me took precedence over that. And so we left 1956 to come to Fuller Seminary. And I felt that the longing to be on the farm and the suffering, in a sense, and the grieving of that loss would be the cross I was to bear for the rest of my life. I was prepared to do that. Within 6 months or so here at Fuller, I woke up one morning and realized that attachment to the farm, that to the soil, that strong sense that that's where my identity was totally gone. I suppose I could return if I had ever wanted to and pick it up again, but I had no need to do that. It was completely gone. And I pondered that and began to think, well, what really happened was not that my father had attached my hand to the soil, but he had attached my hand to my heart, and wherever my heart was, there my hand would be. I had simply taken my hand out of one kind of soil and put it into another. I mentioned this concept of destiny. Let me talk a bit about that. That's probably the most significant thing I have to say today, for what it's worth, a very personal thing with me, and I think it has in some way registered with others. It's from Dietrich Bonhoeffer that I got to this connection between call and destiny. Bonhoeffer, as many of you may know, a German pastor, was executed by Hitler in 1945. Because he was part of a conspiracy against Hitler and had been in prison for 2 years, was in the resistance movement. Earlier in his life, 1930, he had completed a year's study at New York Union Seminary in New York, and there, through his exposure to the black church, Christians in Harlem, and his own sense of his belonging with the people in Germany, especially the Jews, who were being already then persecuted, he decided to go back. And after 1930, he himself and others noted a very profound difference in his life. In fact, he wrote in one of his letters that his earlier work, his academic work, two PhD dissertations written at the age of 21 and the second one at the age of 23, were done in a very unchristian manner. I wasn't even a Christian then, he says. And now, he said, I am committed to Christ. So there was a profound, deep change in his life. He hesitated to call it a kind of conversion. He detested the kind of Methodism, as he called it, which by that one struggled with some sense of psychological, spiritual conversion. He simply turned to Jesus Christ as the one to whom his total life now belonged. And out of that, of course, came his writings on Sermon on the Mount, the cost of discipleship, and so on. Now, Eberhard Bethke, his former student in one of the seminaries of the Confessing Church, and the one to whom he wrote a significant amount of letters, published in Letters and Papers from Prison, his friend during all that time, Bethke, after the war, in his biography of Bonhoeffer, wrote that in 1930 he found his calling, in 1939 he found his destiny. Now, I pondered that a great deal. It seemed that his calling in 1930 was attached, as I have said earlier, primarily to the fact of obedience to Jesus Christ, that Christ was the one that took absolute priority in his life, and that that which was not done out of obedience to Christ was in fact disobedience. But during that time, he struggled to find where he should be, what he should do. When he came to the United States in 1939, in June, it was to escape draft and certain execution, because he was a pacifist in principle, refused to be inducted into the service, and all of the Germans that refused to participate in the service through the draft were executed. There was no place of conscientious objection. He knew that. So the issue for him was either death, because he would not into the army, or to escape. And he escaped with his aid of his friends, got a visa to come to New York, and could have then lived here with relative degree of security and safety through the Second World War. But he, after some weeks, pondered his decision, said, I've made a mistake, I must return to Germany, because my destiny is to be with my people, and I will have no right to participate in the future if I'm not part of the present there. And going back, he knew then, of course, that The door was closed, virtually, to any type of Christian ministry. Hitler, by that time, had taken over the church. And he went back and entered into the conspiracy then to escape the draft, became a conspirator, which meant that he was a double agent. He was a part of the Abwehr, the German intelligence unit. If he had to go out on assignments, he had to collect information from the Allies that would aid the German war machine. So he was, in a sense, a spy. And he had to do that secretly so that many of his friends, even former students, hardly knew what he was doing. Here was a man who was obviously opposed to Hitler, but in this sense he seemed to be cooperating with him. But the German intelligence unit, the Abwehr, was the seat and center of the conspiracy to arrest and assassinate Hitler finally. So he was implicated also in instincts and activities that were directly contrasted to his pacifism. And in fact, in the end, had to say that if it is my lot to be the one to plant the bomb or to pull the trigger to kill Hitler, I will have to do it. I will become guilty of murder. My only defense will be that I have acted in responsibility for the oppressed, and God will have to forgive me as a murderer. There would be no justification for murder, but in the end, there's no justification for being innocent of murder and letting other people die. That was how he struggled with that. Bethke said an interesting thing, that all during the 30s then, when he had found his calling to serve Christ, he was conflicted by all kinds of thoughts of depression at times, some spiritual uneasiness, some restlessness, some uncertainty as to what his life should be. But Bethke says when he came back in 1939 and finally then was arrested in 43, never again did he have those feelings of uncertainty. Never again did he have any sense of depression. Then he had found his place, and he called that his destiny. 1930, he found his calling to be a Christian. 1939, he found his destiny in going back, and found that it was in seeing his destiny to be of service to Christ and obedience to Christ, but involved in the responsibility to stop the horrible crimes that Hitler was committing at all costs. That was to be his destiny. And that sense of destiny, as one fulfilling his obedience to Christ in that secular way, confirmed to him his calling. Now, I have used that of my own life. My destiny was, in a sense, to be a farmer when I grew up there. After being a Christian for several years, I then began to look around. I had heard Charles E. Fuller on the old-fashioned revival hour and heard about the seminary that planted the seed in my mind that, well, possibly to go to seminary and to do some type of Christian work. There was that kind of ambivalence. But as I began to think in terms of my future, where I was to be 30 years from there, I looked around at that little town of 600 people. And there were all the retired farmers sitting there watching haircuts. That's the only excitement in town. I picked out my spot on the sunny side of the street in the winter, and then the shady side in the summer. And there's where I would be sitting someday, waiting to die. My destiny was not to be a farmer the rest of my life, but merely to be a retired farmer. And something in me rose up in rebellion. And I said, no, that is not that's not what will satisfy my soul. My destiny must be something in which I can invest myself to the very end. That's what led me to pick up on that seed thought of going to seminary and thought, well, if I go to seminary, who knows what will happen, but at least whatever I will do, I will be able to do to the rest of my life as one involved in the life and ministry of Christ. And so in 56 we did have an auction sale and came out to Fuller, as I've said before. Now, in that sense then, the concept of destiny for me has been very pervasive. As Jeff knows, I've talked of this often. I'm probably going to die in a committee meeting someday. They'll carry me out here at Fuller. And my only question is, it better be a good committee meeting. It better be a good faculty meeting. If I'm to die in this faculty meeting, if this is my last faculty meeting that I ever attend at Fuller Seminary, it better be the good one. And when I put that test to most of those meetings, I get up halfway through and walk out. I've done that several times, simply saying, almost as though I've put in my time here. I've satisfied my responsibilities as a faculty member. From here on, I don't see anything worth my life. And besides, it's a long drive home, and the freeway's crowded. So I would leave. Now, that's kind of a caricature of it all, but in a certain sense, the concept of destiny for me is very important. Destiny is asking the questions, where will I be possibly 5 years from now, 10 years from now, going on the trajectory that I am now pursuing? And if 5 years from now, suddenly I discover this is the last thing you'll ever do on earth, will I be able to say, yes, this is okay, I have finished. There's nothing else I yet have to do in order to make my life meaningful. So the destiny is what in the end will say my life is meaningful. Now, when I speak of destiny, I'm not speaking of one's eternal destiny. I think we all know that that is a different thing. I'm speaking of destiny in the sense that sooner or later, someday, somewhere, each one of us will have a last day on earth. That's our destiny. Our destiny is where we'll be, what we're doing when we die. Now, we have no control over that, but we can, in a sense, take that into consideration and aim at that. We can orient our life in such a way that I'm moving toward that, which if it's the last thing I ever do, I will have no regrets. Now, I've suggested that as a better criterion to determine where I should be now with respect to the future than a subjective sense of God's call. If I wait for God to call me in a certain direction, that's a very subjective sense. But if I use my call as to serve Christ, and where I am and what I'm doing in this world at the end of my life will be my destiny, then I can satisfy my life of obedience to Christ and my own inward life. And this is how I have done. Maybe it's ironic that this lecture is given by audio tape, that, as I've said, this is the first class that I have ever missed, and 24, going on 25 years of teaching. I've often said that my destiny is to be a teacher. And who knows? I expect to recover. I have every assurance of that. I have no control over it. But I'm prepared to say that if I never teach again, having taught the first half of this course and having given this lecture, there are no regrets. I chose this destiny a long time ago. I chose as part of my life that I would invest myself in this particular task, and there will come a time in which it will be my last one. And if so, so be it. No regrets, nothing further to do. Yet, as the Apostle Paul said, if I'm able to live and go on, so be that too. Each one is a possibility. I remember some years ago, we had a student come to Fuller from, I think it was Idaho, in his I think late 30s, early 40s, mid-vocation type of change. He came feeling now that he was called out of a secular business to come to Fuller, study for Christian ministry, to be a pastor. Within about 6 months of coming to Fuller, he had cancer of the pancreas and was told he only had a few weeks to live. I called him in Huntington Hospital. We talked about this, and he was just incredulous. He said, how is it that I now, at this point in my life, have come to serve God and to give my life to God and to make this decision, and suddenly I'm stricken with cancer? It doesn't make sense. And we talked about that, and I just said, yes, that is strange. It's hard to fathom. I don't know the inner logic of that. And after we talked a while, he suddenly stopped and he said, you know, if I'd stayed in Idaho, I'd probably still got cancer. I'd be in the same condition physically. Coming to California, it didn't give me cancer. I didn't live in the smog long enough for that, I don't think. So probably what's happening to me now would have happened wherever I was. Thank God, he said, that I made the move toward the ministry for the future, though I'll never realize it, so that now that this is my last week or two on earth, I'm moving in the direction of that, which if I had been allowed to fulfill it, would have been the completion of my love for God and service in Christ. I am satisfied. I rest in peace, he said. It was an incredible statement. And a week later, he did die. That was a very confirming thing for me, that when we think of destiny, it's not that we have to reach a goal, But it is that we are, as Paul said, we're aiming toward it. We press forward toward it. And that no matter how far along we get, it's then our destiny. And if we can move toward that as though that goal itself is worthy of our life, it's worthy of God's call upon our life, it frees one in the immediacy from having to make one's decisions based upon a sense that, well, this is God's will that I've determined. God's will is always the outcome of our life. It's God's will is connected with our destiny, not so much with our calling. As it turned out, a year later, one of our students, Matt, who had graduated and had become one of my students in theology, he was very taken with the kind of incarnational theology I was teaching, and we had a great friendship going. His parents were a pastor of a church down in, I think, Laguna Beach, and co-pastors, and he was to be ordained before he was to go out for that denomination to Kansas, into a rural church, and take up the pastor. He's very excited about it. And he said, this is what God has really opened up for me, for my life. He asked me to preach his ordination service, which I did. Went down to that sort of little church where his parents were and preached his ordination service. And at one point in the service, I was led to look at Matt sitting there saying, Matt, what you are now embarking upon is the destiny of your life. It will be that which in the end will confirm the fact that your life given to God cannot fail. Whatever happens, this will be your destiny. I went on to tell the story then of the earlier student who had come to Fuller, who had died, and had come to realize that even though he never fulfilled the calling in a sense and professionally, it was his destiny and it was good. Well, after the sermon, his dad came up to me and thanked me for coming to give the sermon, but then said, we really were saddened by the fact that you cast a shadow over this day of celebration for our son by telling this story of this other student. And I apologized. I said it was not in my notes. I had no intention of doing that. This simply came out, and I said, I take responsibility for it. You are probably right. This is inappropriate. And that was the end of it. 6 months later, his father called me and said, I have some sad news. Matt, who was unmarried, did not show up for a Sunday service in that little church back in Kansas. They went on Sunday morning and found him in the parsonage, and he had died in his sleep. And the father paused a long time and said, now I know why you gave that sermon and why you said that in that sermon. And it is a source of comfort to us that it's true, that it's finally that our destiny in our life in this world, given to God in whatever way, is fully sufficient to justify our life and to give us a sense of completion. Well, I have preached a few ordination sermons after that, and it's never been fatal, so I think that in some way the mysterious spirit, the hand of God, was upon that, and that's a mystery and a marvel to me. But again, it confirms the fact that in the end, as I've counseled many students here, try not to be paralyzed and ambivalent over, is God calling me to do this? Is God leading me to do this? Put yourself 5 years ahead and say, if I complete the course I'm now on, to be a therapist, to be a counselor, whatever it is, if I complete this degree and I move on to this particular task, and if it's the last thing I ever do on earth, will I be able to say, I'm satisfied, I have no regrets? And by putting yourself in that position, you really test out some of the hidden inner motives. Because many times when we say that, we say, well, no, not really. I mean, yes, I would like to be in private practice, I'd like to be a therapist, I'd like to get a degree, I'd like to be a teacher, but I hope to do more than that. But you see, we have no power over that. We do have a sense of power over our destiny in that we can choose to invest our life in something, one thing or another, as though it's the last thing we ever do. We have that power. That is the freedom God gives to us to say that when I make a choice to a career, to a vocation, to a task, to another person, for example, in marriage, it's till death do us part. It is the the last decision that I may ever have to make in life, and it can be a decision that will be confirming of the fact that I not only am called to serve Jesus Christ, I am led by Christ to the end of my life, to the very end, so that my destiny becomes that which determines my choices. Now, I thought at one time my destiny was to be a pastor, and I was comfortable with that. If I had died preaching a sermon, I always prefer to think of dying when I'm doing something. If I had preached my last sermon and the doctor says, that's it, you have a week to live, I would have said, fine, this was my destiny. But at a certain point, beginning to feel that there were other opportunities to teach, and began to say, well, if I leave being a full-time pastor, go to get a degree in theology, become a teacher, if I choose that, I'm choosing, in a sense, to put my hand in that soil, and whether I ever reach it or not, this is what will confirm the fact that I've chosen something which in my service to God will be completely fulfilling and will satisfy the very depths of my soul. Now, that's really all I have to say today. It's not on paper. It's something that could never be put on paper. And I wanted to say it out of a sense of self-investment of myself in the course. And you look at the summary then under 912 on page 31, where I state that the sense of calling is related to the congruence between our inner life and our outer life, where the heart is attached to the hand. The fulfillment of the calling to be Christian is discovered through the vocation or task that satisfies our heart and occupies our hand. Christian calling involves being under constraint to embody the love and reality of Christ through one's life and work. We fulfill our calling through the devotion that binds love for Christ to the task at hand, to make devotion our duty in freedom and grace. In stating openly our intention of fulfilling our calling to be Christian through our ministry of counseling, we clarify our motivations and expose them to correction and healing. Again, as you will remember, I stated that it's our intentions, not our motives, that convey, in a sense, both the moral and the spiritual character of our life of faith. I leave you with this. I hope to see you again, if possible, even before the end of the quarter. But we're prepared to say that this may be my valedictory lecture for this course, at least. I appreciate Jeff giving me opportunity for it. In some ways, our relationship through these past years where we have taught together, for me, is part of my destiny, and I hope it's part of his. And I hope that these thoughts will somehow free you up from anxiety and open the doors for you to look out and to see the place where you can choose to invest your life for Christ without regret and in perfect peace. Thank you very much.